This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Ian Buruma begins his new book, Their Promised Land, with a description of the lavish Christmas celebrations at his grandparents' house in England. This was back in the 1950s and 60s when Buruma was a young boy and a teenager visiting from Holland. His grandparents were well-to-do and Jewish, living very much the upper-class British family life. Buruma tells the story of his grandparents, Winifred and Bernard Schlesinger, after finding a suitcase of their letters, including love letters, written when they were separated by World War I and World War II. He writes that their patriotism and love of England came from a gratefulness. While there was anti-Semitism, it was more social than dangerous or threatening. Ian Buruma joins us to talk about his grandparents and what their story tells us about identity and assimilation. He's a professor at Bard College and joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. A great pleasure. Thanks for joining us and congratulations on your book as well.
Thank you very much.
Your book was a reminder about letters and the kind of longing that comes with letters, because they're not like text messages or email where we get them instantly. But you have to wait for the letter to arrive. You have to write the letter, send it, wait for the response. And there's something very poignant about that.
Well, especially when my grandfather was away during World War II in India as an army doctor for 3 years. And during those 3 years, they never met. And they knew that a letter could take more than a month to get to the other side, if it got there at all. And yet they would write almost every day. And so then you really get into their heads in a way that, you know, one very rarely does with parents or grandparents.
And how many letters did you find? I mean, this suitcase full of letters.
I never counted them.
Well, there were a lot, though, right?
There were a lot, because I don't think they ever threw one away. They kept them all very meticulously, even though they were very private. And I know that my grandmother, when her father died, burnt all his letters because she felt it was inappropriate for anybody to read other people's private correspondence. A pity, because he was an immigrant from Germany and his letters would have been very interesting. So I'm sure that they didn't really want anybody to read their letters, but nor could they bear to throw them away.
So do you feel like a disloyal grandson in that these letters are now part of this book?
Well, it's a tricky question, because on the one hand, I'm their grandson, and I was very close to them. On the other hand, I'm also an historian, and I'm writing as both, really, in this book. And I felt they're no longer alive. The first letters are literally 100 years old. It's history now, and so I didn't really feel too badly about it.
Did you learn anything new about your grandparents that you didn't know when you started reading through their letters? As you said, you were quite close to them.
I didn't. It's always very difficult to know how much new you learned after having written a book, because you forget what you didn't know. I don't think there was any great revelation of me completely sort of rethinking the kind of people they were, because I knew them very well. It's more, I think, in the details that you're sometimes surprised. I hadn't perhaps realized quite, in the case of my grandmother in particular, how anxious she often was about her background. Because I think maybe by the time I came along, there was much less of that. They were older and so on. But
and her background being Jewish.
Yes, and in her case, very much sort of secular Jewish. And it's interesting that I think she felt more anxious and awkward than my grandfather, even though he grew up in an Orthodox household, and his father was Orthodox and his mother adapted to that. So he at least, although he was lapsed and he didn't, they went to the so-called liberal Jewish synagogue once in a while, which is the equivalent in America of Reformed, I think. But he certainly wasn't Orthodox. But he never felt really uncomfortable about it, whereas my grandmother, I think, did. And part of the reason, I think, is that she really didn't know what it was that distinguished her from other people, or why other people would regard her as different, because she had no knowledge of religion or customs or traditions or any of that. So she was Jewish. She came from a completely Jewish family. But it didn't really mean much to her, except that it made her different.
So why did they celebrate Christmas and not just a, you know, minimal religious-y, secular kind of Christmas? This was going full out.
Well, I think I may have quoted Adam Gopnik, the New Yorker writer in the book, who said something that impressed me in an article he wrote about his own family. And he said the Jewishness of his family was expressed in the enthusiasm with which they celebrated Christmas. And it's very much a sign of a certain kind of assimilated Jew, usually well-educated, upper-middle class, who very much wanted to associate with the culture of the majority. It didn't mean that they became Christians or that it had any religious significance to them, but Christmas was a sign that they belonged, and that they fitted in, and that they'd adapted.
You say there's a difference between assimilation and being closeted. And, some people might from the outside look at them and think they're living in the closet. They're not owning their Jewishness. You say it's not that simple.
I think it is a very complicated thing. I didn't coin that phrase. That's from an Israeli philosopher who was born in Uruguay himself, who is Orthodox, called Moshe Halbertal. And he said to me, you know, there's a basic distinction between the closeted Jew and the assimilated Jew. And he disapproved of the closeted and he could live with the assimilated. And I think if you're closeted, you barely acknowledge it to yourself. And you certainly don't want the rest of the world to know. So you're hiding, and they never hid anything. They were completely open about everything, but they didn't make a big thing of it either. So I think assimilated is more apt than closeted.
Well, they didn't change their name to Adams, for instance.
No, they didn't.
Something very Gentile.
And they did go to synagogue, and they never denied anything, but they adapted as much as they could to the culture in which they were born, and that was theirs, in fact.
They had a code word for Jewish. It was the number 45. What would be an example of how they might use that in
a
sentence?
My grandmother may not have known anything about religious tradition, but one Jewish habit that certainly did cling to her, apart from almost a cult of classical music and family, was Jewish geography. Whenever you introduced a new person to her, the first question would almost always be sort of, is he 45?
As opposed to Jewish?
No, not as opposed to. That meant Jewish.
Ah.
It was the code word for Jewish, 45. And where it came from, I have no idea. I know that from a description of my German ancestors, written by a great uncle, that in Germany in the 1870s, when they got together in public, they would talk about Italians because they didn't want to draw attention to the fact that they were Jewish. I don't think it was used, 45 was used in that spirit. It wasn't because they were afraid of anything. It was a family code word, and many families have family codes. And again, it's a mystery where this particular phrase came from, but it's stuck.
They had a neighbor, a Colonel James, who didn't like the name Schlesinger and didn't like the money. So clearly there were people in their orbit who did not approve of your grandparents.
Yes, but what is typical of my grandparents is that he was always treated as a bit of a joke, Colonel James, and don't like the name, don't like the money, when they moved into the village. And I think they were much too proud to be too bothered about that kind of casual anti-Semitism, of which there would have been a great deal, certainly when they grew up and when they were alive. And in Britain, perhaps because Britain had not been under Nazi occupation, it was never as much of a taboo as it was in Holland, where I grew up, which had been under Nazi occupation, and that meant that there was a lot of collaboration and a sense of guilt. And so when I grew up, and this may also be changing, but when I grew up, it was rarely a taboo to openly make anti-Semitic statements. You just never heard it. In private, maybe, whatever people thought is another thing, but you didn't hear it. In England, you did. And Don't Like the Name, Don't Like the Money is a very mild version of this.
But, yeah, but, very but they treated British, it, it sounds.
Yeah, but they treated really as a sort of running gag at family dinners.
You tell a funny story. You're a little boy and you're going to visit, I guess it's Mrs. James, for tea with your grandmother.
Yes.
And you...
I misbehave.
You misbehave. Go ahead.
Well, my grandmother, again, as part of her anxiety never to stick out and always to fit in and do everything properly, I mean, she would get dressed after working in the garden, especially to go and pick somebody up at the station because she didn't want the station master to see her in her gardening clothes and that kind of thing. So she was a real stickler for doing everything properly and respectably. And Mrs. James had asked us for tea. And she was a kindly old woman with a slightly frightening lion-like face. And she was the widow of Colonel James. And my grandmother impressed on me that I had to be on my very best behavior. And there was one very sad thing, which was that Colonel James had just died. So whatever I did, I should not bring this up because it would make Mrs. James very sad. And Mrs. James had laid on a big tea with cakes and chocolate and this and that. And I apparently behaved very, very well. I must have been about 5 or 6. And everything went fine until we left and we began to drive off. And Mrs. James stood by the door and waved at us. And suddenly, on mad impulse, I stuck my head out of the window and said, "Colonel James is dead! Colonel James is dead!" And my grandmother was, of course, absolutely mortified. I'd broken down every rule that she'd constructed for herself. And I must have, part of my childish mind must have known it. And one way to attract attention, of course, as a child, is to be shocking. And it's sure. It's an impulse that never entirely disappears.
But you think, you know, you're a little boy there, obviously, but that you were also exacting some kind of revenge because Colonel James was anti-Semitic?
I think that's to give myself far too much credit. I don't think I was aware of that at all. I wouldn't even have known at that age what it meant, what Colonel James might have meant by this. So I could claim to be to sort of stand up for my race or something like that.
Right.
I don't think there was anything to do with that. No.
Were you sent to your room without your supper?
I can't remember what happened afterwards. I do remember that she lectured me and was very angry, but I can't remember the consequences.
You say, and I think this was a friend of yours saying that your grandparents were the most English people he had ever met.
Yes, this was an American friend of mine, and we visited them. This must have been around 1979, and that was the impression he had, and the impression was correct. I mean, they were very, very English, or perhaps one should say British. We had a distant relative who was a refugee, an artist from Germany, and who came to England in the 30s, and he naturalized. And somebody once complimented him on his mastery of the English language. And he said, "I don't speak English, I speak British."
British. Ian Buruma is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's got a new book. It's called Their Promised Land, My Grandparents in Love and War. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation, and including a reading from the book as well, from one of these letters. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, talking with writer Ian Buruma about his new book. It's called Their Promised Land, My Grandparents in Love and War. It's an account of a love sustained through the separation of two world wars. Buruma found his grandparents' letters in a suitcase. And while they do tell this story about their long love affair, it's also about assimilation and identity. Ian Buruma is a professor at Bard College. And if you want to join the conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Your grandparents' names, Winifred and Bernard Schlesinger, once they got married, how did they meet?
They met one Sunday afternoon at a family gathering at which my grandmother played the violin. And my grandfather, I think, played the cello. He was no good at it, and she became very, very good.
He knew he was no good. Did he do it because he saw this beautiful woman and he wanted to
get
close to her?
No, I think it was part of the expectation And my mother had it, unfortunately, because I was no good at all at playing an instrument. But you had to play a musical instrument. This was part of your education, which I think was very much part of the sort of the German-Jewish tradition from which they came, in which music was something set above almost anything else.
As your book is about these long periods of time when they didn't see each other because of World War I and World War II. And I'd love to have you read a section from one of their letters. It's actually your grandfather to his grandmother, and they have an incident that they're trying to deal with and trying to understand.
Yes. I mean, to put the letter in context, because of World War I, my grandfather, becoming a student, medical student, was delayed, and so he had to get his degree and get a job and so on. And they got engaged, but had to wait for many years before they could get married. And in those days, that meant that they pined and longed and kissed and didn't do very much more. And so it's unimaginable today when, you know, you would never delay anything like that. But it also accounts for a sort of red-hot passion in their letters that is also hard to imagine now, because, you know, nobody pines and longs and so on in the way that people did in those days.
That's a perfect setup to reading, yes.
Here's the letter.
And this is your grandfather to your grandmother.
My grandfather to my... Wait a minute. No, it's my grandmother to my grandfather.
Okay. Sorry.
Bern, my one and only love. I'm afraid you must have thought I was very stupid and prudish the other day, but what you told me at the dance just gave me a bit of a shock at first. I always imagined, as far as I ever considered the subject at all, that that type of picture was supplied just for one type of man and not a very desirable type, and that your type loathed it and was repulsed by it just as much as I was. And so at first I was a little shocked and self-conscious, like I was when I first heard about all the relations between man and woman. But once I have assimilated these ideas and got used to them, it's quite all right. Men are just fundamentally different from women. They have different feelings and conceptions and a totally different outlook on life. You see, I'm very proud of my sex and of the honour of my sex, and it seemed to me that that kind of picture must debase us, and that once a man has seen a woman so stripped of all modesty, even if it is only a picture of one, the whole sex must sink in his eyes and be held lightly by him forevermore. And, of course, he was very apologetic about this later.
And he clearly shown her a picture, I guess, of a naked woman or some...
Well, yeah, or told her about something. It could be that he was a soldier in World War I, and part of the time was spent in the Middle East. It was famous for its sort of pornography and that kind of Alexandria and places like that. So her response, of course, is in some ways not entirely unlike some modern feminist views on pornography. But sex was clearly people thought about it in a very different way in those days. And, you know, he certainly, but she probably in her way was equally desperate. But, you know, they had to wait.
Yeah. And he apologizes profusely, and then she writes him back and says, I understand.
And she says, I understand. And then she says, it's in the nature of men to go too far, and it's the duty of women to stop them. And she then blames herself and says, I should have stopped you. Again, something that's now very hard to imagine.
So what does that tell us about your grandmother and grandfather?
Well, that they were very proper about these things. And, of course, not everybody in those days was. And my grandmother was one of the first generations of women to go to university, and she was at Oxford exactly at the same time that Evelyn Waugh and others were there and misbehaving in all kinds of ways and sort of getting drunk and shouting and avant-garde poetry through megaphones and boys going to bed with boys all the time, and sometimes with girls maybe too. There was no question of this in my grandmother's case. I mean, it was cocoa evenings and
Was that kind of code word for...
Not cocoa evenings. No, literally, I think they would make cocoa and have friends over, only women. And any man that came to her college had to be chaperoned, even if they were engaged. So different mores can go on at the same time, depending on the group you're in.
Now, both of their parents came from Germany, so they were German Jews.
Except for my grandfather's mother, who was born in Manchester, but she did come from a German Jewish family, and all the others came from Frankfurt and Kassel.
And were they well-to-do? Educated,
they were certainly educated.
And
I wouldn't say upper class. I think one side of the family had a textile business, and I think the other had a store in Frankfurt selling musical instruments. So they were sort of middle class, but certainly not rich. And my two great-grandfathers worked as stockbrokers in the city of London. One was very good at it and made a considerable amount of money. The other one was not and preferred to listen to Brahms and things. That was the story.
You have a little aside here about how Jews from Eastern Europe looked at German Jews. I mean, there was maybe it was a class difference or some kind of a difference, but there was, I won't say tension, but perhaps people looking up or down on each
other. No, I think there was
a
lot of tension, and the tension is still there. I mean, even today in New York City, it's very easy to for these things to reemerge. There was the sort of middle-class educated German Jews were very assimilationist and very keen to be as German as they could and so on. And they looked down on the Eastern European Jews, especially the ones in shtetls, who were religious and traditional and much poorer. And the German Jews were the sort of types who, if they ended up in Palestine, would wear a three-piece suit in the sort of subtropical heat. And so the Eastern European Jews resentfully and disdainfully called the German Jews Yekkers, and the German Jews looked down from a great height at the Eastern Jews.
No one in your family spoke Yiddish then, right?
No, and probably wouldn't have for several generations.
Is that because it was the language of the shtetl?
Yes, I think there was a real class divide, and people from their class, even already in Germany, I think had done everything to get away from the sort of Yiddish-speaking world, and they much preferred to go to Bayreuth and listen to Wagner. And I think there's a reason for that too, why so many Jews liked Wagner, which is that it allowed Jews, assimilated Jews, to celebrate Germanness without being Christian. And Wagner's music, and especially Bayreuth, in some ways is a sort of quasi-religious shrine to German culture. And you could go there and revel in this without having to convert.
And yet Wagner was a
ferocious anti-Semite.
Yes.
But one of his conductors was Jewish and so on. And certainly a lot of his fans were and continue to be.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Ian Baruma, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's written many books, including Murder in Amsterdam, Year Zero, The China Lover, Occidentalism, God's Dust, Behind the Mask, The Wages of Guild, Bad Elements, and Taming the Gods. And he's got a new book. It's kind of a memoir called Their Promised Land, My Grandparents in Love and War. The war being, of course, World War I and World War II. They grew up in England, and our guests grew up in Holland and would visit the family from time to time. And again, if you want to join the conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Your uncle, their son, was?
He died.
All of a sudden, I couldn't remember if he was John Schlesinger.
He died in 2003.
Okay. Was the famous movie director, John Schlesinger. Mm-hmm. And he plays a pretty important part in this book.
Yes.
His parents, your grandparents, worried a lot about their son, John.
They did. And that was, in a sense, a revelation to me because he was always idolized by all of us. As the great family success, and certainly my grandmother adored him, and they were very close and so on. But when he grew up, and he was at a rather Spartan boarding school, and he was hopeless at all the things that boarding school boys were supposed to be good at, like sports and so on, his interests were entirely in sort of family theatricals and applying makeup to my mother and dressing up in his mother's clothes and that kind of thing. And so my grandparents were very worried about him and thought that he would come to no good.
Well, I'd love to have you read a letter that they wrote about your uncle, their son, John Schlesinger.
Let me see
we have so many post-its in the book here.
Yes, I got it.
We have it there. Great.
Okay. This is my grandmother writing. I'm extremely worried about John and really cannot wonder at his school career. He is the laziest, most selfish and feckless boy I've ever come across. He's not interested in the world's affairs and seems quite unaware that there's a war on. He sits in an armchair all day unless forcibly evicted and listens to rubbish on the wireless all day. I'm afraid I must sadly say that our eldest son is a washout. Apparently, many of these qualities are the cause of his unpopularity at school. The boys had him on the mat one day and asked him what he was interested in or was any good at. When he quoted music and drawing, they said his music was rotten and his drawing average. A perfectly good assessment, I consider. Mm. My grandmother could be a little harsh in,
yes,
in her views, somewhat tempered, I think, when I knew her. But I recognized the voice. But, of course, this assessment of her son was completely reversed later when he was so successful.
Your uncle was gay as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, was that also part of their worry, is that he liked to make up and
no,
wear...
not at that stage, interestingly enough. There are certain remarks where they call him, quote-unquote, a little too pansy. But I don't think it really came... I don't think they really thought he was gay, and people didn't really think in those categories at the time so much. I mean, some of my grandfather's best friends were clearly gay, and in those days people called them confirmed bachelors.
Mm.
But I think it was seen as something that was more a life choice than something that was inherent in a person. And I think my grandfather, well, he says so in a letter in 1945, that nothing about John that can't be put right by the right girl and so on. And it was really after he was a student at Oxford and he had an unhappy love affair with a man that they realized and very quickly accepted it, which is also unusual because, don't forget, in those days, this would be, you know, around 1949-50, it was still very much illegal. I mean, you could go to prison.
It was a crime, isn't
it? It was a crime. You could go to prison. And so the fact that they accepted it so readily is actually rather remarkable, especially in the light of the letter I read earlier on. And I remember Christmases, and he would very often have a pal, and they would share a bedroom, and there was no bones were made about it. It wasn't discussed, but it was completely accepted.
You tell a story of being a young man and having a male friend, and your father having some worry about what was this relationship about.
Fathers probably still worry about these things. I mean, we may be living
in more
enlightened times,
but
I think many fathers probably still deep down do. And yeah, this was
for their sons. You think
for their sons, and I think this was to do with me. I was 12, and my friend was 14, and we used to go on bicycle rides in the dunes and stay away for a long time. And my father got a little worried and said, "So what do you and Axel," that was his name, "get up to in the dunes?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, do you play games?" And I said, "What kind of games would we play?" He said, "Well, like pulling each other's willy," rather diffidently said. And I said, "What?" And then I was so obtuse that I went to Axel, who was not too bright, but and I said to him, "You wouldn't play games like that." And he wasn't too bright, but he understood much better than I did what was implied. And I didn't see much of Axel after that.
Oh, is that right? Goodness gracious. Times hopefully are changing. Your grandparents also, this is during the Second World War, rescued a number of Jewish children, mm-hmm, and brought them to England. And I guess took care of them or made sure that they were taken care of.
Yes. I mean, this is the famous Kindertransport.
Right.
And what happened is that after the terrible pogrom in 1938, the Kristallnacht, many people, not only Jews, but many Jews and also Quakers in Britain, were galvanized into trying to help as many children escape from Germany as possible. And the government agreed in the end to take these children as long as they were privately sponsored and left their parents behind, so they could only come as orphans. But many came and many were saved. The interesting thing about my grandparents is that they decided to rescue 12 children from Berlin before the Kristallnacht, and not only rescued them, but took care of them, paid for their schooling, and kept up with them for the rest of their lives. I still see several of them fairly regularly. And whenever the names of my grandparents come up, people's eyes tend to mist over because they saved them.
There's a beautiful photograph with these children with a Rabbi Zimmet in Highgate. And they're all sitting on the steps, and he's playing what looks like maybe
a
balalaika.
A mandolin or something.
Yes.
And the widow of Rabbi Zimmet, now well into her 90s, is still alive and living in Poughkeepsie. And so, yes, this is where my grandparents, despite all their sort of, Yekka behavior, really did show solidarity and did the right thing.
And did the right thing because they saw what was happening and wanted to help these, at least help
well,
some
it's
children?
Well, the question is, why did they decide to do this before other people did? And there are hints in the letters. And one thing is that neither of my grandparents liked to complain about anti-Semitism. They felt that they were above that. But there were instances, and one was when my grandfather was desperately trying to find a position as a doctor in one of the London hospitals and had great difficulty. And one of the hospitals, St. Thomas's, turned him down, and it was clear why. And he sent a letter to my grandmother saying, it's the old story, 45. And this sharpened, I think, his attitude, and he realized that this was a real problem, and he had to save people who were having even worse problems.
That's Ian Baruma, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's titled Their Promised Land, My Grandparents in Love and War, based on a suitcase full of letters that his grandparents wrote to each other. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with writer Ian Baruma about his new book. It's called Their Promised Land, My Grandparents in Love and War. He's a professor at Bard College. He grew up in Holland, has been living in the States for about a dozen years or so, and is our guest in this hour of Radio Times. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. We've been talking about his grandparents' life and their life during World War II, living in England. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. An email from Elizabeth says, hearing about your German-Jewish background and how classical music was taught and seen as almost above all else, this reminds me of my family. When growing up, I thought classical music and art museums was what being Jewish meant. It was what made me most different from all the non-Jews and the non-German-Jewish Jews, she says as well.
Yeah, that's very much the experience in my family too. I mean, it was a sign of, since the so-called Jewish Enlightenment, when Jews were allowed to be secular and so on, it was a sign of education. It was the way to make a mark on the world and so on, and that you had to be more cultured than the rest, which is why, of course, a lot of the most important figures in German culture and people, critics and so on, writing about German culture, and were Jews, because they often knew more about it than most Germans.
I know Jews who to this day don't want to go to Germany. They don't buy German cars. They don't listen to Wagner. And yet your family, there was a place for Wagner in the family.
Yes, because they felt, of course, Wagner's ideas were vile. Of course he was an anti-Semite, but music is music, and that transcends everything. And so certainly my grandmother was not keen on Germany. And in World War II, both of them became very, very anti-German. It's interesting to contrast in the letters their attitudes in World War I and World War II. In fact, in Britain, anti-German feeling was stronger in the First World War than it was in the Second World War. The Second World War, the enemies were the Nazis. In the First World War, was the Hun, the Bosch, the Germans. And that irritated them, because they were too close to Germany to be able to do that wholeheartedly. In the Second World War, of course, they became ferociously anti-German. And at the same time, there was an ambivalence because they didn't want to be thought to be refugees either. They wanted to be in the war, but very much as Brits. At the same time, of course, rescuing Jews and so on. But even that was complicated.
Your grandfather served in World War I, as you write in this book, something he didn't really talk much about. And I guess what we know now about that war, it was just a horror.
Well, he saw the worst of it because he was a stretcher bearer. And when he was still in training in 1915, he was worried that he wasn't being sent to the front soon enough because of his German name, Schlesinger, and not knowing he was going to be a stretcher bearer on the Somme. And it would have been one of the most horrific things. And in a much, much later letter, there's just a little hint of it when he says, one of the most memorable things was meeting you, my grandmother, and the other thing was having to pick up the pieces of people after a direct hit on our trench. As one of his most vivid memories. That's the only thing he says. And he clearly did see the worst, and so he didn't talk about it.
No. Which I think was common for a number of people who served in that war. There was a kind of stoicism, I guess, about sharing what you had observed.
Well, first of all, you weren't allowed, of course, in letters sent home to say very much. That would, demoralize the home front and all that. But they are sort of weirdly stiff upper lip. And thanks for the chocolate cake. And it's a little uncomfortable here. Rather a lot of rats. Cheerio, that sort of thing. And
very
that was,
British.
Of course, very much the image he lived up to.
Let me see what Deanie from Roxborough has to say. Deanie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, I was going to say my grandparents emigrated from Eastern Europe and came to the United States, and my grandmother said she would never live in another ghetto, so I grew up in an ethnically integrated neighborhood. My grandfather decided that he would go into business for himself and became an ice man. My grandmother put two of her four children through college, and I experienced a lot of anti-Semitism when I was growing up. I was born in 1930, and had a college quota. My uncle was in medical school, but he had to wait a year to get in because he was Jewish. And I was stuck in a car with a real estate person who was showing me a property and said, "Are you Jewish?" And when I said yes, he said, we don't rent to Jews." Mm. So this is, was in the 50s in this country. So I just wanted to say that although we weren't German Jews, we were Eastern European Jews, and my grandparents never spoke another word of Polish or Russian again. My grandmother said, "We're American. We want to speak American." And the other general language was Yiddish because she didn't want us to hear some of the stuff, I guess, over the kids' heads. But that was her absolute goal, was to be an American.
Well, Deanie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And I remember my husband is Jewish. His family is Jewish. And his grandmother would say about her father, who had come to this country from Eastern Europe, he's a real American. I mean, that was the goal, to be, at least for this family, to be a real American. Does that fit your analysis?
Yes, of course. And the question, of course, is not whether immigrants, and the same applies to other immigrants from other religions and other ethnic groups and so on today. It's not just what you aspire to yourself. It's one thing to say, "I want to be an American," or British or French. It's another thing for the majority to accept you as a fellow American or a Frenchman or a Brit. And this is causing still considerable problems, more so in Europe probably than in the U.S. But that's the nub of the problem.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think Europe has a bigger problem, I guess, integrating?
Well, because outsiders? I think America is obviously a country built by immigrants. It's the New World. And everybody, if you go far enough, is an immigrant. And so there is a common aspiration to be American. And in the end, I think most people who want to be Americans and live like Americans are accepted as such. But it's not quite so easy in old societies where people have a fixed idea on what it is to be French or German or whatever else it is, to accept that people who look different and perhaps have different food and so on are still fellow citizens. And, I mean, it's not that this problem doesn't exist in the United States. We know from a lot of the rhetoric coming out of campaigns today that it's still very much here, too.
Let me quote something you write in this book. You say, if you are in the majority, you can afford to swim along with the mainstream without giving it too much thought. But a Jew in a society of mostly Gentiles, a Muslim in Europe, a black in a predominantly white country, or a homosexual, especially in places where love of your own sex is unaccepted, is forced to consider his or her place more deeply to make up his or her own story. That when you're a minority, you have to think about these things in a deeper kind of way.
Well, I think that's why so much literature today in the U.S. Specifically, but everywhere, so much literature is written by people who grew up in minority families. I mean, whether they're Muslim or Indian or Chinese or Korean, it doesn't really matter. But that's where a lot of the richness is now, because not because those communities are necessarily more talented than others, but because it forces you to think more deeply. And that comes out in art, among other things.
Does that describe you to some I don't know about your life growing
up
in Holland.
Well, I wouldn't dare say that about myself, but yes, in this, not about my relative talent, but it is certainly true to say that growing up with parents from different cultures at a time that this was much less usual than it is now, even in Europe. Now it's common, but it did force me to think a lot about these things. What made people different? What is the nature of belonging and so on, culture, tradition? And it certainly was never a source of trauma or pain, but it did create a certain attitude and a fascination.
You wrote a book about, it's called Murder in Amsterdam, about the murder of Theo van Gogh. This was, about 10 years ago?
A little bit more.
And he was stabbed on the streets of Amsterdam.
By a man of Moroccan origin,
right.
And who, like so many of these young terrorists, had been converted very recently on the internet, largely, to this extreme form of Islamism. He didn't understand much about Islam. The pattern is very common. That they start off, you know, they chase girls, they drink beer and so on, and then something in their lives snaps, and then they convert and they can become terrorists, and that's what happened in this case.
And I read a couple of reviews of your book just to remind me, but it seemed that, at least in the case of this terrorist/murderer, it was when he found out that his sister was dating, that seemed to be the thing that set him off.
Yes, but it could be anything. The best way to understand this phenomenon psychologically is to read Joseph Conrad about anarchists in the early 20th century. The rage that some people carry with them, that they're not noticed by the world and they will bring the world down and themselves with it. And there is something very nihilistic about it. We have to live with that now.
Well, apparently we do. Is that how you see it? Because depending on who you talk to, some people say these are nihilists, as you say, they're filled with rage. They feel as if the world is sort of out to get them. And then you see others that say, no, they're just like the regular, you know, they're just normal people that grew up in normal middle-class life.
I think both is true, because they are often normal people who live in middle-class families. But it's when something snaps, and it could be anything. It could be the rejection from a girlfriend. It could be not getting a job you wanted, blaming that on the world. But it can happen very, very quickly. And if you read the life stories of many of these killers, whether it's the ones in Paris or Boston or wherever, the stories are weirdly similar. And when they grew up, nobody really thought that there was anything unusual. And suddenly something happens in their lives.
And you think there's a reason it's happening now, or happening more commonly now?
Yes. I think partly these things are contagious. And so they come like waves that sweep the world, especially now with the communications being the way they are and the internet and so on. Partly because, unlike, say, Hindus or Buddhists or Christians or Jews, there is a kind of ready-made revolutionary ideology for Muslims now. that promises belonging and power and revenge and so on. And that strand of Islamism is appealing to people who are vulnerable in that sort of psychological way, and because it's there. There is, for a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Jew or a Christian, it's harder. There isn't this ready-made revolutionary ideology. Of course, not too long ago, sometimes communism was an excuse to do these kind of things.
I'm thinking about sex, frankly. I mean, there's also the promise of virgins. And also we hear about the sexual abuse of girls and women that are under the control of some of these groups.
Well, a lot of it has to do also with the authority of the father. And the problem is not with immigrants. The problem is the children of immigrants who grow up in the West, who are born in the West. And some men have particular problems because they see their parents being ridiculed in stores and not having authority. The paternal authority is often very weak. And the sons don't quite know where to turn, think that on the one hand, Western women are easy and easily available and so on. When things go wrong, then the same women that they were attracted to then become sluts in their eyes and don't deserve any better than to be abused. Sisters who have boyfriends are seen as people, again, who defy authority. And so they crave authority and rules and then can become very extreme.
Well, I don't want to make a connection between that and your grandparents, but in certain ways it is about assimilation, identity, whether it's self-identity or how people see you, how others see a person.
Well, I think it's always difficult for immigrants, I mean, or children of immigrants and grandchildren of immigrants, to the process of becoming part of another culture is never easy, and you're never going to be accepted by everybody. There's always going to be discrimination, and some people cope with it better than others. My grandparents were helped in that they were relatively privileged, could go to got the best education possible, and so on. And then you can move in circles where you're in some ways shielded from this. If you're poor and not well-educated, you're much less shielded and you're much closer to violence and so on, and so more prone perhaps to use violence yourself.
We're almost out of time, but you also have made a connection between poverty and religion. I mean, you add, I guess, religion to that, and it becomes even more intense.
Yeah, one has to be very careful, especially in this country, to make statements like this. The president got into trouble, and I don't want to do the same thing, but I think it's true to say, as a general statement, that the more vulnerable people feel, for whatever reason, and poverty is certainly not the only reason, the more vulnerable people feel in the world, the more likely they are to find sustenance of one kind or another in a belief system. And poverty can be one reason for vulnerability, but it could be something else too.
Well, Ian Buruma, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. He's a professor at Bard College, the author of a number of books, including his new one called Their Promised Land, My Grandparents in Love and War, and based on a suitcase full of letters that his grandparents wrote to each other. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program, how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Nick Kowalski is our new intern starting today. Welcome to Radio Times. Diana Martinez, our engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.